Thank you. So, well, thank you for having me, hosting me at Perimeter. I love being here. It's a great place to meet people and start new collaborations. So I'm going to be talking about a four-part high quantum assistant VAE as a calorimeter surrogate. So as Roger mentioned, I'm a research associate at Triumph. So this is the team working this project. Some of the members there are no longer collaborating directly in the project, but they still did some heavy lifting. So you have Wojtek and Max, my supervisors at Triumph. Sebastian just joined as a co-op student. Hao is a PhD student. Abby Check and Semi Mool, they did a lot of the heavy lifting, the first part of the project. Then Tiago is a postdoc at SFU. Søren was an exchange student from Lund University in Sweden. We have Roger, Jeffrey Fox from University of Virginia, and Eric Paquette, from a collaborator from NRC. And so that's the map of UBC.
The A100s.
Yeah. So Jeffrey Fox, he did a lot of high energy physics in the 60s and 70s. And like if you Google him, you'll see that his name appears, followed by Feynman and Fields and Wolfram. And so, yeah, it's cool to have him also in the project. He now focuses like on high performance computing, and he's helping us primarily on that, I'd say. And so that's UBC, and Triumph is located around this area right here. So this is the west side of Vancouver. Downtown is over there. It's pretty nice over there. If you ever go to Triumph, if you ever go to Vancouver, I can give you a tour of Triumph while I'm there. So simulations play a crucial role in the design of future experiments and also on the analysis of experiments at the LHC. So the way this works is that you have the accelerators, you have your experiments, you get data from those experiments, and you have the simulations. And so you generate data from the simulations, and they both go through the same pipeline. You analyze it, and from there, then you validate your hypotheses or you don't. And so thing is that the LHC is going through an upgrade. And so in a few years, we're going to have the high luminosity LHC. And so we're going to be getting a lot more data per event because they're changing the detectors. And so the simulations need to catch up with the experiments. And so on the top right-hand side, you can see a plot there, which you have years and annual CPU consumption. And so there's a gap between what's required and what is offered from CPU right now. So basically, the requirements of CPU to generate the data from these simulations is not possible with the current trend, with the current CPU available. So in order to mitigate that gap or just be able to fix that gap completely, we would have to be a bit creative, figure out ways in which you can do the simulations a bit faster. So what they use is this thing called Gion4, it's a simulation. And a fully event, which I'll explain later what a fully event means, takes around one CPU second to generate. And part of the, like 40 to 50% of that time just goes from simulating the calorimeter in the detectors, right? So basically you have a collision, or maybe, let me switch, okay. So basically you can see there, you have a collision here, and then you generate particles, an electron, and starts going through the detectors. And as it goes through the detectors, it deposits energy in the detectors. And then you start getting new particles and you create these showers. And so in the experiment, you measure the energies deposited in these detectors. In Gion4, what you do is you track all these particles. So you need to keep track of all of that, but you're really interested in the energy deposited in these detectors. So the question is, can we go directly from the initial particle, say an electron with specific energy, to what you would measure on these calorimeter detectors? And if we do so, can we actually find a way to, would this speed up the simulations?
So just for the kinetics matter people, so what are the future LHC runs or whatever looking for? now that the Higgs boson is found?
I think they're I mean, I don't know the exact answer to that, but they're interested in generating more boson Higgs, because if I recall correctly, like speaking to Max about this, so they generate like 500,000 boson Higgs, but they have all these trigger mechanisms in which they just keep certain amount of the data, and I think it's like 1% of the data or 0.1% of the data. So, and the way you build these triggers is by figuring out, okay, by maximizing the likelihood, because you basically just measure energy on these calorimeters, right? And you have different types of calorimeters, right? And so you basically need to go like, okay, so if I measure this energy here and this energy in this other detector, and on the other side, I measured this other signature, maybe that's because there was a boson Higgs over there, right? So you have to do this inverse problem of figuring out things. And so these triggers are built on that. Like if you see certain signatures, you keep the data. And if you don't see those signatures, you basically don't keep it, right? So I think the approach is going in that direction, right? Yeah.
So I heard a lot about the double Higgs decay that people have been searching on in the colliders for the next possible signatures for beyond standard model physics.
Yeah.
And you mentioned bosonic Higgs. So bosonic Higgs and double Higgs decay, those are different things, right? Bosonic Higgs.
Bosonic?
Yeah, the one that you're mentioning, that should be... Is that the double Higgs decay that people are looking for?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question, yeah.
I see. And what people are trying to do is just look for signals which might indicate to a breakdown of the standard model physics and indicating beyond standard model. Mm-hmm. Physics.
Yeah. Yeah, like for instance, what Max is doing is trying to find perturbations to the Higgs field and find like further corrections to see whether the actual, like the Mexican hat, has further perturbations to that. Yeah. That's pretty much all I can say on that side of things. Yeah. So the idea would be, so can we build this box here that would take input from GEON-4, and then you have a quantum assisted generator model, you generate data and it goes back to GEON-4. And so inside the box, you would have something like a QPU that passes data through the decoder together with this GEON-4 and goes back to GEON-4, right? So I'm basically going to focus on that part of the, on that box right there, right? And so this is the contents of generative models, because what we were using is a variational autoencoder, which we couple it with a restricted Bolzmann machine in the latent space. And then we are able to map that to a quantum annealer. And once we have that, then we can use it with a specific data set, use the quantum annealers. And so I'll explain the data set, show the results, and lay out some conclusions. Okay, any questions? All good. Okay, so I know everyone here is an expert on generative models, but let me start with the simplest generative model I can think of, which can simplify things as we go along. So the simplest generative model to me, it's the Box-Müller method. So if you want to generate Gaussian distributed numbers, you can do so by generating uniform distributed numbers. You generate two and you plug them into equation one and two, and you generate Gaussian distributed random numbers. And so the trick is finding those two equations there. And so when you do that, you basically aren't sampling anymore from a Gaussian distribution, you're sampling from the uniform distribution. And using these functions, you go to the Gaussian distribution. So generative models, it's precisely finding these functions right here, and you use deep learning to write a loss function that will allow you to find these two functions right here in this simple case. So that's one key idea. The other key idea here is that to obtain, in this case, like these two equations, what you do is a change of variables from one distribution to the other. So you basically say, so this should be normalized for the uniform distribution, this should be normalized for the Gaussian distribution. When you change variables, you use the Jacobian times the uniform distribution, and you impose that this must be equal to these two Gaussians. And so that's how you get these two equations. And so as you'll see, that's pretty much what's behind the reparametrization trick, that it's used on classical VAE and what you use in the discrete VAE. So in our case, we have a vector this vector is it's composed of voxels, and each voxel contains the measurement of energy of a given event. So for a given event, you have an energy of incidence. And these voxels go through the encoder, conditionalized to this energy right here, and you project them into this latent space. And then once you have it encoded, it goes through the decoder, and you try to generate the same thing that was fed to the encoder. And so you normally define the encoder as this distribution that depends on phi. And then the latent space has this distribution that you chose a priori. And the decoder, you associate it with this distribution right here, which depends on theta. And so the loss function that you try to minimize is this thing right here, which is the log of that distribution over there. And then this term right here, which is like Liebler-Kullback divergence. So the first term is a reconstruction. It's just in charge of making this match with this right here. And the second term is in charge of making the latent space learn basically the features of your data set. So once you train the model, you toss away the encoder, and then you just sample from latent space. And so one of the things that you come across when you're working with this is that you want to build discrete estimators. So you sample, say, your latent vector C from your distribution Q, and you build some discrete estimator. And then when you take the gradient, on the left-hand side, you can take the gradient if you have the analytical form. But when you go on the right, on the right-hand side, it's sort of difficult to take the gradient with respect to the limit in the sum. So that's where you do the change of variables, similar to what you would do in the Box-Müller example. So what you do is change variables, and instead of sampling directly from Q, you sample from a normal distribution, and you generate these latent variables C from sampling from a normal distribution, and these two terms are the terms that you would be training on the encoder decoder. And to do that, well, the last equation shows basically the connections between the two distributions. So that's the reparametrization trick that you would use in variational autoencoders. Now what we do is we replace the latent space. Instead of using what traditionally people use, which is a Gaussian distribution a priori, and so that's why it's like a hypersphere, you replace it with an RBM, so now your data set lives in this hypercube in the vertices of this hypercube. So why do we do that? It's because it's more expressive, because well-restricted Bolzmann machines, you can train them on their own, and they're very powerful too. That's generative models, right? So we're embedding a generative model inside another generative model, and we hope that it would be actually more powerful. There's a cost to this, and so again, I know there's so many experts here on RBMs, but I'll go over the basics. So RBMs work in the following way. So you have some data, V, and so these are vectors, and each element can take values of 0 or 1. And what you try to do is you fit, again, your data to some distribution, which is a Boltzmann distribution, and you do it by maximizing the log likelihood. So the distribution has this form, the Boltzmann distribution. This is your energy function, in which you have A, B, and W, your fitting parameters. And you have this, your partition function. So what do you do to fit your data to the Boltzmann distribution? You maximize the log likelihood. When you do that, you get these two terms right here. And the problem is that when you try to take these expectation values, you need the partition function. And so if you're working with an RBM which has n nodes here, m nodes here, then you have 2 to the n plus m possible states. And so pretty quickly, it becomes untractable to actually compute the partition function. So you have to do something which is called the Monte Carlo Markov chain, right? So if you start playing around with the conditional distributions of the hidden layer given the visible layer and the visible layer given the hidden layer, you arrive to these equations right here. So basically you go from the Boltzmann distribution to, by conditionalizing, to a two-level model. And from there, you can basically sample V to given an H vector, which is kept fixed. Once you do that, you can now fix V and generate H, and you keep doing that. And eventually, if things go well, you should arrive to a minimum. So that's what you do in order to compute these expectation values here. And so the recipe is right here. You start with an initial vector. And so you plug that initial vector right here. You multiply by the weight matrix transpose. You add the B vector, apply the sigmoid, and then use those as parameters for a Bernoulli distribution, and you generate that, an H vector. And from that, you repeat the process, but now for H to generate V, and you keep going a lot of times, and you eventually reach a sample for V and H, which you can use to take these averages, right? But you have to repeat that a number of times equal to the batch size that you're using. And that's only just to update the weights that you're trying to update in your energy function, right? So you have to do that a lot of times. So that can take a lot of computational time. So basically, this process, what it does is, say you start with a vector in your data set, you do this skip sampling of this Monte Carlo Markov chain, and you should land in some sort of minimum. And then when you do back propagation, you're basically moving that landscape towards your data set. So it's very powerful, but it takes a lot of time. But in any case, we use that. We put the RBM in the latent space. And so now we have to do the reparametrization trick, but we have another issue. These RBMs, they use discrete variables. So how do you backpropagate through the decoder to the encoder, from the decoder to the encoder? So what you can do is just say, okay, so my latent variable is going to be a sigmoid of some function right here, right? And you modulate that with a tau parameter. So it's controlling the steepness of the sigmoid. So when it goes to zero, it becomes really steep. And when it's large, then it becomes very, very smooth. So that allows you to backpropagate all the way to the encoder. Now, the other thing is that you need to sample from a different distribution that does not depend on these parameters. So it turns out that if you take a logit number and you add the inverse sigmoid of some uniformly distributed random number, you generate a categorical variable. You generate a binarized vector. So that's why we use this trick right here. So basically, similar to what you would do in a traditional VAE, in which you generate a normally distributed random number, you generate a uniformly distributed random number. And instead of generating from the encoder the mean and the standard deviation, what you generate from the encoder is this logit right here. And this is just one parameter that we tune as we train the model. So that's the Gumbel trick.
I never saw this before you guys showed me. Has anyone ever done this before?
You mean the Gumbel?
Before we started.
Before
YTAC.
I think people the way they do discrete VAEs is using the Gumbel trick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So discrete VAEs were there before,
mm-hmm.
and then what they did was applied it on the Gallo data set, so that became Gallo VAE.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The Gumbel trick is also used for other regressive models. So it's like we backpropagate through sampling, through the regressive sampling use.
I guess I meant specifically the RBM, is the latent space.
For the RBM? I'm pretty sure it was used for...
It was from in Dewey's paper. They proposed that, yeah. And they...
Is that the first time?
I believe so, yeah.
Cool.
I mean the...
Approximation, right?
Sorry?
Trick is still kind of an approximation, is it not?
Yeah.
Well, the tau is an approximation, right? Because the thing is that if tau is not very close to zero, then you won't be getting binarized samples, right? But if it's very close to zero, then you have problems with your gradient. So you basically start with a large value and you start annealing it. Right?
Yeah. So I mean, basically, like you have biased gradients in this case.
You could, but I think that because there are other ways that you can instead of doing the Gumbel trick, you know, that you use like the gradient of the log of something, right? But that also has some biases, right?
The score estimator is unbiased. It's just it has very high variance.
Mm-hmm. Right. It has, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's just training off.
Mm. So, but I mean, I'm pretty sure that as long as you churn the tau, you make it 10 to 0, you'll get good samples, right? Okay, so you put the RBM there, yeah, and so it comes at a cost, but you can avoid that, and that's where we can replace the RBM with a QPU. So, okay, so quantum annealers, so it's an array of superconducting flux quantum bits with programmable spin-spin couplings. So basically what you have is an array of qubits, and they're coupled in a specific manner that it's it depends on the physical space and how you can connect the different qubits, right? So you're basically limited by the physical space. And so what you do is that these quantum annealers rely on the adiabatic approximation, which basically states that if you have a Hamiltonian and you start with an eigenstate corresponding to that Hamiltonian, which has an annealing parameter, and then you start doing the annealing, by the end of it, even though your Hamiltonian has changed, you're still in the same eigenstate, right? If you do it correctly, right? So that's the motivation behind this quantum annealer in D-Wave. And so because there are many problems in which that can be mapped to a Hamiltonian that looks like this, right? In which you have some couplings which are relating these qubits. So if you can map your problem to a Hamiltonian like this, then you can potentially use quantum annealers to solve it pretty quickly. So the goal is to find the ground state, or that was the goal when this was built, but in practice, quantum annealers, they do couple to the environment, so you have decoherence and thermalization, but in our case, that's actually good because we're using an RBM, and so if this thermalizes, then that means that you basically have a Boltzmann machine there, right? So you can just sample from it, right? What's not good is that when you do that, when you start doing this quantum annealing, there's a region there in which the system can get trapped in a local minimum, right? Which is very common when you're working with like spin glasses, structural glasses, right? So basically, it'll depend on how quickly you move this annealing, right? So and similar to what happened in glasses or spin glasses, if you quickly quench your system, it can get trapped in some glassy state, right? So in some cases, the difference between like the Boltzmann distribution and the actual state you're in the quantum annealer is quite large, but in other cases, it's not as problematic. So there are different protocols you can use to mitigate that. So when you use D-Wave's quantum annealer, you can actually change that. In our case, we haven't really change those parameters. And so up to now, I've just talked about a fully connected RBM in which you have all of, in the case of a two-partite graph, you have nodes on the visible, and each node on the visible is connected to each node on the hidden layer. And it's two-partite because there's no connection in between nodes belonging to the same partition. But in the case of Chimera quantum annealer, you still have a two-partite graph, but it's a sparse restricted Boltzmann machine, right? In the sense that you'll have nodes here which are connected to only a few nodes right here, right? And so this is the Chimera topology. And so for instance, the orange dots are connected to these green dots. So the orange dot would belong to one partition, the green dots would belong to another partition. But if you see here, like this orange dot is not connected to this one right here, right? So you have that sparsity. So Chimera is no longer available in D-Wave, and now what D-Wave has is Pegasus, and so it's a four-partite graph. So that means that you actually have four partitions, and you have connections from each partition to any other partition there, right? And it's also sparse, right? So we basically tailored our RBM in our model to be able to fit into Chimera and into Pegasus. And so this is how the model looks. So as I mentioned, you have an event that goes into decoder, and the condition of the incidence energy goes to the encoder. You generate part of the encoded vector. And then we have another encoder that takes in this part of the encoded vector together with the event and the energy of incidence through the encoder to generate the other part of the encoded vector. And what this is called hierarchy levels, and it's supposed to be better for the model. In our case, we haven't necessarily seen any improvement from using this or not using them, or even using 10 hierarchy levels, but currently we're using 2 hierarchy levels. And then, so you use these 2 encoded vectors, they go to the RBM or the quantum annealer, and you train the RBM or quantum annealer. And then they also go through the decoder together with the energy of incidence. There's a line that should go through the decoder. And then here we have 2 decoders. One generates the hits and one generates the activations. You do a Hadamard product and you generate this event. And so for that, we use these loss functions. So the divergence Kullback-Leibler, which is training the RBM or the latent space. And we have the MSC, which is typical, and this binary cross-entropy with logits.
I can't understand why the hierarchy would help. Is there a mathematical proof for this?
Basically what you're doing is somehow conditionalizing these not only to the events, but also to this C vector. And so in a way, since you're going to be using these 2 vectors in the RBM, if you have a 2-partite RBM, it sort of would mimic the way in which you sample the hidden layer by fixing the visible layer, and then fixing the visible layer, you sample the hidden layer, right? So it's sort of trying to mimic that on the outside, right?
I'm thinking to myself, one might argue, if you make your encoder complicated enough, you can accommodate for, like, instead of making it hierarchical, you can make your encoder, your original one, as complicated as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a mathematical, like a theorem or something that says if you actually do a hierarchy, you would need less parameters, or is there a definite advantage in doing this as opposed to just making your encoder more complicated?
As far as I know, there's just evidence from the people that came up with the discrete variational encoder that when they use that, they see an improvement in their model, yeah.
But you said you haven't seen it, right?
I haven't seen it, yeah. We're just using it because, we're using that as our baseline, yeah.
Also about that, one more small point. So in hierarchical VAEs, the interesting thing is that you have like different levels of latent space. So the idea is that each level of latent space should capture like different features.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, this, I don't know how to show you this. This is like, if you interpolate in the first level of latent space, you'll change these features.
Mm-hmm.
If you interpolate in the second level, you'll change these features. So it's kind of like... You know what I'm saying? Why can't you do both in one single...
I think what he's saying is that you can just do it in the same convolutional neural network. You could see that the first layers in the convolutional is going to affect some specific features, right, on a higher level, and as you keep going, yeah.
Serial text, I think OpenAI also has a website on it, that if you look at a particular layer, like a kernel, you see that you can see like it has learned like a bunch of faces of poodles, for example. Like it can only recognize, the activation function only lights up when it sees poodle images. And like another kernel, if you look at it, it only learned like what red Corolla looks like or something like that. And, you don't really need to, hierarchy, make a big hierarchy of these things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah absolutely.
It's just similarly, the RBM itself, just not good enough. You just get the VAE part.
For the event generation?
Yeah.
The thing is that you... Like, my first guess would be, it could be enough, but you still have to map your data to some binarized data, right? And so when you're modeling energy and the range of values goes from 0 to, I don't know, 5 times 10 to the 9. So I think that's a trick that you need to find a way in which you can encode it first and then use whatever you want in the latent space, right? So one of the things I want to show you, so basically why are we separating the hits from the activations, right? Because you would say, well, basically the hits, it's a binarized vector, 0 and 1, and it's just telling you whether that particular voxel is getting hit or it's not getting hit. Right? And the activation is giving you the magnitude of that energy, right? So why are we separating it instead of just getting the output directly, this x hat, why are we separating into that? And so I think like the argument here is because in these events you'll find regions in the detectors in which it doesn't get hit, right? So you want to be able to reproduce events with the right sparsity, like events in which voxels are not hit, right? And so you could use a threshold, right? You could say, okay, so I'm generating just the x hat, and if x hat sub I is lower than 10 to the minus phi, I'm going to assume that it's not, it hasn't been hit, right? But when we try that, you don't get that level of sparsity that you see from the events, right? And so it turns out that if you separate it this way, by assuming that the H vector follows a Bernoulli distribution, and the A vector follows a Gaussian distribution, it actually works a lot better. And so the argument, the way you could see it here, is that instead of modeling this distribution here, you specify it as the Hadamard product of the activations times the hits, and then you write this distribution, this joint distribution, conditionalized to the energy of incidence and the latent vector, as this product of distributions, A given H and whatever, probability of H given C and whatever. And so you say, okay, this is a Gaussian distribution, provided it get hit, and it's a Delta Dirac, provided it doesn't get hit. And then you have your Bernoulli distribution, in which your this term right here is Heaviside function over the target value, right? But then when you reach here, it would be very difficult to actually model this, because it's very difficult to actually model a Dirac delta. Like, this is a term, like, if the voxel doesn't get hit, then you want to output energy equal to 0, right? But it would be very difficult to train that, right? So you simply replace this A and this A right here with the actual x hat, and you reaccommodate terms. And so this is basically the distribution that we want our model to learn, right? And so when you put that inside the log, you get the MSE and you get the BCE right here, right? And so that's how it comes about.
Javi, also, yeah, the conditional probability you have set, and then E input, right? And what are the, you have dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, so in this case, dot, 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 it's nothing, but I mean, it could be conditionalized in the future on other different aspects that could come from Gion, right? Yeah, but in this case, it's just conditionalized to the latent vector and the energy of incidence, yeah.
I didn't quite understand. You added these terms up because it's actually quite hard to train on delta A, well, A is, where A is zero. So you replaced that part also with a Gaussian.
No, so basically just, so if you replace the A with the X hat here, so basically, so you can replace it, and then you say, well, if it doesn't get hit, if it doesn't get hit, then I really don't need to figure out this part right here, because I'm already masking it with H, right?
Yeah, and so you added these two up right now, as in like H plus 1 minus H, because you got rid of H.
I got rid of, yeah, this, yeah.
Oh, you got rid of this, but where's H then?
No, so, and then I have to normalize it, right? It has to be normalized, yeah.
I was thinking, like, there are two ways of looking at this. It's as if you were, if you also replace the delta with the same exponential, and assume that that captures x equal to a for some reason, then the addition of these two gives exactly that.
Oh.
So the, mm-hmm. It was interesting the way that the result of renormalization is equal to just replacing the exponential with a Gaussian.
Right, and another thing here is you'll notice that we're actually dividing by x, and that's also something interesting that we found that. So again, we're measuring these voxels, they contain the energy, right? So these are Poissonic events, and so when the value of the energy, and these energy values are proportional to the number of hitting events in that particular voxel, so when the number of events is very large, you can replace the Poisson by a Gaussian distribution with standard deviation equal to x, right? So that's what we're using it, right? But it turns out that when we train models using that specific type of Gaussian with standard deviation equal to x, we don't get as good results as when we train using a standard deviation equal to one, like the thing that you would use when you're training models on pictures and stuff like that, right? And so that's something that we haven't truly figured out. Why is that? Because it seems like this would be the physical way to model it, but if we use we try the other way, it actually works better. Okay, so the data set that we're using is it comes from the Kalo Challenge data set, and it's from electron showers. So basically, people in the LHC, they created these data sets, and so you have the detector right here, and you have some showers in the middle, so collisions happen right around here. And so they basically mapped the energy in the detectors to voxels inside this cylinder, right? And so what we have is this cylinder right here, which is turned into a one-dimensional vector, right, which has around 6,000 elements on each event. And so these cylinders, they have 45 layers. So you have 45 layers there, and then each layer is composed by 9 lines in this way, like slices of pizzas. And then you have these, and then you have these 16 circles around per layer, right? So when you do that, you get the 6,000 plus voxels in there. So probably this didn't tell you much, but basically, like, we're focusing on a very simple case of events, right? Because the hard part happens on this part of the detector, right? So this is where you get sort of easy events, which shouldn't be difficult to model, right? And here, what I'm showing is some results in the case in which you use the Chimera typology. As I said, we cannot sample from D-Wave in the Chimera typology because it's no longer available, but we basically just train an RBM with this Chimera typology. And so here you just have the reconstruction versus the ground truth energy per event. So basically, we generate these, we reconstruct the events, and we sum the energy of the vectors. And so what you're looking here is, well, that reconstruction versus ground truth. And then here is the sparsity I mentioned. So the sparsity index is defined as the number of voxels which are empty divided by the total number of voxels. So it goes from 0 to 1. 1 means that it's pretty much sparse, it's empty. And so you have ground truth here and reconstruction. It's also, I would say, pretty decent. And then here, what's really important is the samples, right? So this is the histogram of energy per event. And so we have ground truth, reconstruction, and samples. So that means that we're sampling directly from the RBM, just conditionalizing to the energy of incidence that we want. And this is for the sparsity index, right? So we get a decent match without actually tailoring too much the architecture. And then this is for Pegasus topology. So it's a four-partite RBM. It's the same thing here. In this case, we have the samples using QPUs. And so you could see that it's not as good as the samples right here. And similarly here, it's not that good, but it's decently well. So why is that? Well, it turns out that the D-Wave machine has its own temperature, but you don't know the temperature. And so you need to figure out the temperature and then rescale your samples from D-Wave to actually fit them, right? And so that's actually what Semi did for Chimera. And so the recipe that we're doing right now is that you generate samples to figure out the temperature or the scaling factor. You generate n samples using Gibbs sampling from your RBM, and then you generate n samples from your quantum annealer, and you compute the mean, the average energy of your RBM and the average energy from your QPU from those samples. And the ratio between those gives you this parameter, beta QPU. And then you rescale the energy of your RBM, the couplings, you rescale them by that factor when you map them back to D-Wave. When we compute this, it turns out that it's 1/8. And so when we rescale, now the energies, you could see here is after rescaling, and over here is before rescaling, right? So it's so now the samples from QPU, they look much more similar to those samples generated from the RBM. So yeah, those are the current results, the time it takes, right? So I mentioned at the beginning of the talk is that when you use Geon, it takes roughly like 1 second per event. And so if you want to generate 1,024 samples, the part of the calorimeter would take around 400 seconds to generate, right? So with this model, if we just sample from the RBM using this this NVIDIA card, it takes 2.9 seconds to generate. And then if we use QPUs, it takes 0.18 seconds, right? So then you still need to add to this one, and this one you need to add the decoder time, which is 0.01, right? So you could see that the QPU is 12 times faster than GPU, and the QPU pipeline is around 10 times to the 3 faster than the Geon, right? And so when you use D-Wave, you also get this information right here. So it's telling you the anneal time per sample, the readout time and the delay time, and you can actually tune those parameters. You can change it. We haven't done that, but you can actually change that.
Crazy. I guess I don't understand what Geant 4 really is.
It's the box that does the simulation.
It's inside.
I mean, the part of the calorimeter is a bunch of Monte Carlo simulations in there. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is more of a first thoughts on infrastructure. So these are the sort of things. So right now we're just using that data set for electrons, but there's another data set for photons, for pions, and so you could specify. To this box, you can specify you can conditionalize, right? The model with the particle type, the energy, the location, and whatnot. And then, well, to be able to deploy, you would need like QPU, GPU resources, networking, and then how do you merge back into this box and then continue the pipeline over there. However, there are other things that also are relevant here because. So while our results are, I would say, good enough, right, we still haven't really defined a level of accuracy, right? And we're still working on the nice parts of detector, right? And it's actually like a clean version of the data set, right? We still have to define level of accuracy. We need to know whether we can actually model the difficult parts of the detector where the good stuff is. And then also what happens with rare events in the distributions, right? So that's basically what we're working on right now, how to define metrics in that sense. And with that, this is the last slide, so thank you for your attention.
Matt, you had a question, right? I was just curious, is the 1/8 like meaningful in your effective temperature?
The 1/8. Is it meaningful? It's meaningful in terms of the results because I think you can appreciate that when you don't rescale the energy, you get. I'll show you
one for this one. Yeah, I just meant like the value itself, like.
Why you're getting at? So I think you got a value of 1 over 10, right?
Yeah, 10.
So in Chimera, I mean, this is something that might be interesting. So in Chimera, Semi got a value of 1 over 10, right? And so in Pegasus, it's 1 over 8, right? And so these are the beta parameters.
This is beta, right?
Yeah. And then the documentation of these annealers, it says that the temperature in which it operates, Chimera, it's 20 millikelvin, and this is 15 millikelvin. So I think that if you compute the ratio between these, it sort of makes sense, right? It's around the order of what you would expect, right? That's the Because in the end, that's what you're trying to correct, right? For the temperature, because the RBM, by definition, it has temperature one, right? And then and the annealer has a different temperature, which we ignore, right? So this doesn't have units, right? Because the energy doesn't have units, right? But it's captured, but you can see from the ratio that it's sort of in the order that you would expect, right?
So my question is a bit longer. So can you please give a summary why you do each of these steps? Or I can start from my perspective. So on the one hand, you have that you want to approximate your probability distribution better than with a variational autoencoder. And on the one hand, after you have settled that problem,
mm-hmm.
so you saw somehow that the Boltzmann distribution for the latent space is better than a Gaussian distribution for the latent space, and then you suddenly have the problem that while sampling from a Gaussian distribution is extremely fast, by switching or by assuming that the latent space is now a Boltzmann distributed, you have the problem of sampling.
Yeah.
So sampling from a Boltzmann distribution is a lot slower than sampling from a Gaussian distribution. And in order to solve that problem, you use a
Okay.
So then the one question is, so is the when you say the sampling time, is that a valid measure of? So I could imagine so like cooling the quantum computer or buying it. Is a lot more expensive than buying a bunch of GPUs, for example.
GPUs, yeah.
So I don't know if that's when you say you're 100 times faster, that it is a good measure.
So no, I mean, that's a very good question. So the numbers I'm providing here is just numbers that we're getting on, say, on a dev side, right? Of course, when you want to deploy that, there's probably some overhead. There's definitely some overhead involved in that, right? And there's probably going to be some breaking point in which it's better to use NVIDIA, or like GPUs, before using QPUs, or the other way around, right? So we haven't really looked into that. But I think that, I mean, the fact that you're able to sample from a QPU and it's 12 times faster than a quite decent NVIDIA card, I think that it tells you that there's potential in it, right?
Yeah. And did you have didn't see it. Did you have a slide where you compared the latent space? So when you train a variation autoencoder, you assume it is a Gaussian distribution, but in the end, what the latent space looks like is not necessarily Gaussian distributed. And I assume it's the same with when you use a restricted Boltzmann machine too. So you assume that your latent space is Boltzmann distributed, but in the end, when you look at your latent space, it is not really Boltzmann distributed. But probably why you use a restricted Boltzmann machine is if you then look at your latent space, it is much closer to a Boltzmann distribution than to a Gaussian distribution. I mean, sure, one is trained with a variational autoencoder with
mm-hmm.
the one loss function, one architecture, and one with the RBM cube, the RBM part,
mm-hmm.
I'm confusing myself. So sure, these are different latent spaces, but if you train the normal autoencoder, the normal variation autoencoder,
mm-hmm.
then you assume a Gaussian distribution, and when you train a RBM autoencoder, you assume a Boltzmann distribution. And have you compared these two distributions? Somehow,
I mean, I think Semi has looked because when he was looking at the measuring the temperature, I think you were. I mean, he had to compute the histograms of the energy the energy that you get from the samples, right? But when you say that you don't actually have a Gaussian distribution in a traditional VAE, what do you mean? Because
in a traditional VAE, you assume that you have a Gaussian distribution, but in the end, your latent space does not necessarily need to look Gaussian distributed.
Yeah.
So that means when you sample from your latent space, you do not necessarily
replicate your input distribution. And I assume it's the same thing with RBMs, except it's better with RBMs, probably. That's why you're quite.
The thing is that, so I didn't try using a Gaussian distribution in the data space, but I know one of the person who was working on the project, he initially tried using the Gaussian distribution instead of an RBM, and that didn't work.
I think the question is a little bit, I think it's a little bit more detailed than that. I mean, I think he's right, as in so if you assume, if you put Gaussian priors, it's mostly just to enforce continuity in your latent space. Not exactly, because afterwards, if you sample the latent space, you're definitely going to see a Gaussian distribution. You might see an asymmetrical Gaussian distribution. You might see even a more complicated, depending on also how much emphasis you put on your KL divergence or other distances that you're using in your probability distribution. But you might get something that is not the Gaussian distribution, even with the Gaussian prior.
Yeah.
So I think what he's asking is, if you use the RBM, do you really, if you sample your latent space and you make a histogram, do you see a Boltzmann distribution, or do you see something similar to it, but it's different? What do you see after? I might be wrong.
Mm. No, no,
But one question. But when you're sampling from the Gaussian distribution, you're saying that you're sampling conditionalized to specific label, right? And then you look at the histogram and you say, okay, so the histogram for this particular conditional, it's not a Gaussian distribution, right?
Yeah.
That's what you mean. Oh, okay. Yeah, because I mean, by design, you say it's going to be a Gaussian distribution, but then the embedding starts.
For the samples, you're saying there is a Gaussian, because in the reparametrization trick, after you have a bunch of numbers for your, let's say for the normal VAE, you have for your means and for your variances, log variances, for standard deviations, then you sample from those a bunch of numbers that come out of Gaussians.
Yeah.
But then as a whole, when you put different samples in and you sample different latent values for different samples, different input samples, you don't necessarily see that the histogram of your Z values.
Because mu and sigma are changing, right?
It depends on what your input distribution is.
Yeah.
I have a question. It might be a little digression, but now I have to ask. So you're talking that you're mentioning that it may not purely remain Gaussian. How are you training the VAE?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Let's go back to basics. So if you are starting with the VAE with conditions so that at initialization, you have a Gaussian distribution, which is just by the choice of how you initialize the weights of the architecture and then what number of nodes you have chosen in the interface. And then if you just limit yourself to the loss function, which can keep the mean and the covariance of the weight distributions close to the initial values and does not add up to higher moments of the weights. So there's a theoretical derivation for that. Bringing in theory, because you can actually show that under certain constraints, you can stay very close to a Gaussian distribution during and throughout training. So your trained distribution in that case would be a Gaussian distribution.
But that would mean...
It might not necessarily always be. So
but what you're saying is that you would always get the same output from the encoder, right?
Sorry?
That would imply that you're always getting the same output from the encoder.
So your mean and covariance are going to shift.
But I mean, so I'm trying to... So what he's saying is that when you don't get... When you pass a lot of inputs to the encoder and you look at the samples that you get, it doesn't look like a Gaussian, right? And that makes sense to me because the output of the encoder is going to change. It's not going to be the same, right? So the mu and the sigma is going to be different, and you're not going to have a strictly Gaussian, right? And yeah, actually, what you can do, or what I've seen with GANs, is that when you do that, when for a specific, say you train on MNIST and you use it for a specific label, you actually get sort of Gaussians, although not a bit skewed, conditionalized given the same label, right? But if you plot the whole thing, it's not necessarily a Gaussian, right? Because you're getting different mu's and different sigmas from the encoder, right?
When I said back to the basics, and I think her question was also interesting, that what isn't your distribution of your inputs kind of like a Boltzmann? Don't they have a Boltzmann distribution?
For my input, no.
What do they have then? What's the distribution on your inputs?
So the distribution of that, it should follow a Poissonic distribution. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I can't really see intuitively why a restricted Boltzmann machine works better than a Gaussian, I suppose. But I mean,
no, but the thing is that we're encoding, but we're encoding it. But the thing is that, or the way I think about it is that you can put anything you want on the latent space as long as you can backpropagate and fix whatever issue might arise, right? And essentially what we're using is the encoder decoder is just to map it to this latent space, right? So the way I would see it is that we're essentially using an RBM to generate these events, right? But we need something that can map our data set, which has big tails and has rare events and a bunch of zeros, to map it to something that is zeros and ones,
oh,
right?
So I can go from, like, invert the process. So instead of saying I'm inputting an RBM in between, in the latent space of my variational autoencoder, I'm putting a variational autoencoder around the RBM.
Yeah, so I think that would be better.
The essential part, and then the variational autoencoder is acting as an embedding.
Yeah, I think that's probably a better picture. Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you this in chronological order because so this is one of the first papers that came out preprints from the group, and in this case they use a discrete, but before that they use a Gaussian distribution in latent space. That was before I had not joined yet. Yeah.
This is 2022.
Yeah.
Because I think the DWAVE paper was in 2018, wasn't it?
The DWAVE paper?
Yeah, about the. I was looking it up actually.
For the discrete?
Yeah. The RBM, like the in the quantum variational autoencoders. It says. And you put an RBM.
Path towards.
Restricted Boltzmann machine. That's what you did, right?
So the paper that you should look at, I think it's Path Towards Quantum Advantage by D-Wave.
Okay, I was looking at quantum variational autoencoder.
I think that's the one which includes Roger, right?
No.
No?
It's actually from D-Wave.
But I think Roger has some, yeah.
Not just the quantum Boltzmann machine.
Yeah.
That was VAE.
I mean,
yeah.
No, this does not include Roger.
Muhammad Hossein Amin?
Muhammad Amin.
Yeah,
okay.
He's the one.
That's the guy. Yeah.
Muhammad Amin? Yeah, he's their RBM guy. He's probably listening right now. He's the one who taught me what an RBM was. Bogdan went there for MITAX, like 2015 or something, and he came back with his RBM. I'm like, what the hell's an RBM? I'm
wasting my life with this stuff now.
Should have shut the recording off there. Actually, let's do that. Let's thank Abir again and get this recording shut off.
Thank you.